In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken through all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. Zadan sanchan tam shelo chisu drawers and be left his soul, shalom to drawers and be left his soul, and shulpa silvers and be left his soul, shulpa yishes to drawers and be left his soul. I pray for blessing, may my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing, may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing, may confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dan nu chen ke chulhum da da mi ke nam dang dro a tan chi dra ke jit sam par tan chi ke jit da ki chit ten dro. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And now the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And the four limitless aspirations, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they never lose touch with true happiness, which harbors no suffering. May they come to rest in vast, impartial equanimity, free from attachment and aversion. So we will check in with our posture. Make sure we're straight and relaxed. And if you remember the other 7 points, you can use those. And just taking a moment to let our attention come to rest in our body, the feeling of our body. We could do a brief body scan from the crown of the head, down the back of the head, just noticing what it feels like. Just tuning in down the face, the eyes, the mouth, the jaw, the ears, down the front of the neck and the back of the neck into the shoulders. Just noticing, letting go of any tension you may find, but no big deal, just mostly noticing. Down both arms simultaneously, to the upper arm, to the elbow, down the lower arms, to the wrists, the top, the back of the hand and the palm and each finger, front and back, all the way to the tip. Down the back of the body, the upper back, middle back and lower back, the front of the body, the chest, the rib cage, abdomen, into the hip joints, the pelvis, our seat, grounded on our seat, down both legs simultaneously, the top of the thighs and the back of the thighs, into the kneecap and the back of the knee, down the front and back of the lower leg, the shin and the calf, noticing our ankles, our heels, the top of our foot and the sole of our foot, both feet, and the toes, the top and the bottom of the toes, the ball of the foot and the toes, all the way to the tips of the toes. And now, settling into an awareness of the entire body, what it feels like to be in this body, in this place, in all our scattered places, but whichever place you're in this present moment of awareness. Remembering the precious human existence, really feeling appreciation in our heart for this opportunity to practice together and all of our opportunities to study, contemplate, and practice the Dharma in this lifetime. That will really help us when the second thought kicks in, impermanence and death. We appreciate before we get to that point, and we make use of our time before we get to that point when the opportunity disappears because of circumstances, and especially at the time of our death. All we'll have at that time, according to this thought in the Nundro text, is our Dharma practice. That's the only thing that will go with us through the death process and through Vargas in our next life. And remembering that it's up to us, that it's our own actions that determine what happens to us in this life and in future lifetimes. If we engage in harmful actions, we reap suffering. If we engage in helpful actions, beneficial actions, we reap happiness. And if we engage in practice, we reap liberation from samsara and the true ability to help other beings. And then the reminder that samsara is all suffering, so no point in just wanting a better samsara. We need to free ourselves completely from all of samsara. So resting in the feeling of our body in this present moment. Now requesting the blessing to empower our practice of the Lama or the Buddha or a deity that we feel a connection with, visualizing them on the top of our head, floating on a lotus wing seat, in a body of light, radiating light, love, compassion, and awakening. And granting our request, we receive their blessing, and the visualization descends into our heart center, in the middle of our chest, continuing to radiate love, compassion, awakening, and light. And it's always there, whether we're thinking about it or not. And so we will segue into ultimate bodhicitta by following the breath for a few rounds. And if you don't need to follow the breath, you can just go directly to open awareness. About 25% of our attention on our focus, if we have one, and otherwise completely open to all sensory input, internal and external. When we have a focus, it's within the context of opening awareness. Very vast and spacious setting for our alertness. And to go through the steps towards resting in the nature of mind, first we disengage a bit from our internal thoughts and our external environment by realizing that it's really no different from a dream. Really resting in that sensation of maybe I'm dreaming this. And if I'm dreaming it, it's of no consequence. So I can just let it go. No need to cling on to any experience in a dream. And just see where the dream takes us next. And then examining the nature of unborn awareness, or of awareness which is unborn, we turn our attention, or a small part of our attention, to look at the mind that is perceiving our experience as a dream. Where is that mind located? We just gently ask the question and immediately let our mind rest. Who is experiencing everything is a dream? Where is that located? Just glancing off the question, maybe we don't even need to ask it in words, but just letting our awareness tune in within the context of this vast, spacious awareness that we're resting in. And having tuned into our awareness itself, without letting go of our awareness of everything else, we let even the remedy release naturally, meaning we let go of any concepts that may be supporting our resting. And we rest in the essence, the basis of everything, where everything comes from, we rest in that. If any thoughts arise, we just let them go, let them pass. Don't interfere with them. Don't cling on to them. If we find ourselves caught up in a chain of thought, we just let it go gently. Coming back to rest in non-conceptuality, in no difference between the experience and the experiencer. And within this state of resting and whatever arises, we practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. We all know how to do that now, so let's just do taking and sending. For anyone that you feel called upon to do taking and sending, loved ones, people you see on the news, neutral people in your life, or people who irritate us. And now in the interest of refining our practice of patience, let's bring to mind someone who does irritate us in a small way or a big way, whatever level of irritation you can contain without turning into negativity. And do taking and sending for them because they are our benefactor. We want them not to have suffering, even though they're irritating. And now expanding that visualization to everyone who irritates us, people who have irritated us in the past, people who may irritate us in the future, thinking that we can meet them with taking and sending and practicing that now in preparation. Really generating a heartfelt wish to relieve them of suffering. Understanding that the ways in which they irritate or harm us come from their own suffering. And with a pure and genuine wish to relieve them of that suffering, not for our own benefit, but for theirs. Expanding our intention to include all sentient beings, whether they irritate us or not. They've all been our mothers in past lifetimes, and they'll probably all be our enemies in future lifetimes. Breathing in their suffering, letting it dissolve, and breathing out happiness, healing, peace of mind, and fulfillment of all their needs. And now thinking that all sentient beings, including ourselves, all beings in all six realms of existence, are completely free from suffering and completely filled with happiness and peace of mind. And we are all completely awakened. We are all Buddhas in this moment. Just resting in that feeling. And now letting go of all visualization and conceptualization, back to open awareness. And if it's helpful, you can do some focus on breathing or sensory perceptions. And gently coming back to our study and contemplation mode. So in the interest, if anybody has anything they'd like to say, get my attention now, and then we'll go on to the verses. All right, so we're going to go on to the verses then. I'm going to share the screen, and today we're going to shorten it a bit. We'll chant them all sometimes today for the first 19, we're just going to do the name, except verse 1, we're going to chant all of it. And then we're just going to do the number and name of the rest until we get to verse 20. Verse 1, to study, contemplate, and meditate. Practice 2, to leave my homeland. Practice 3, to rely on solitude. Practice 4, to let go of attachment to this lifetime. Practice 5, to give up negative friends. Practice 6, to rely on spiritual friends. Practice 7, to seek refuge in the three jewels. Those are the preliminaries, ongoing practices. The three levels of motivation. Practice 8, to refrain from harm at all costs. Practice 9, to strive for unchanging freedom. Practice 10, to liberate all beings. Practice 11, to exchange my happiness for others' suffering. That is the root practice for all the verses. Practice 12, to repay theft with generosity. Practice 13, to repay harm with compassion when someone attacks you for no reason. Practice 14, to repay slander with love. Practice 15, to repay humiliation with respect, seeing them as your teacher. Practice 16, to repay ingratitude with affection, with greater love. Practice 17, to repay disrespect with reverence. Practice 18, to maintain resolve when all goes wrong. Practice 19, to maintain focus and humility when all goes right. And now we'll chant the rest of them in their entirety. If I don't tame my inner enemy, the poison of aggression, anger, hate, then outer enemies just multiply. No matter how to vanquish them, I fight to tame my own mind with an army of the forces of compassion, kindness, love. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Since pleasures and desire are like salt water, the more I drink them in, the more I crave. Therefore, the moment that attachment stirs, to drop it right away without a pause. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. Now the ultimate bodhicitta verses. All appearances are my own mind. Mind's nature from the start is concept free. To know my own mind's nature and refrain from grasping onto subject-object signs. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. When I encounter something that's delightful, such as a rainbow on a summer day, to give up all attachment to its beauty and never cling to it is truly real. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. All forms of suffering are just like dreaming that my beloved child has passed away. Appearances like these are just delusions. To take them as true drains my energy. When I encounter adverse circumstances, to see them as delusions of my mind, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And the paramitas. If wishing to attain awakening, I need to give even my body up, then doesn't it go also without saying that this applies to mere external stuff without hope for reward or benefit, to generously give away a gift. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. If through a lack of ethical conduct, I can't accomplish my own benefit, then any aspiration to achieve the benefit of others is a joke. To keep and guard my ethical conduct completely free from worldly influence, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. And we'll do the patience verse three times. For bodhisattvas wishing to accrue a wealth of wholesome virtue and good deeds, all harm is like a precious treasure trove from other people or adversity. To cultivate a patient attitude, not feeling irritated or abused, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. For bodhisattvas wishing to accrue a wealth of wholesome virtue and good deeds, all harm is like a precious treasure trove from other people or adversity. To cultivate a patient attitude, not feeling irritated or abused, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. For bodhisattvas wishing to accrue a wealth of wholesome virtue and good deeds, all harm is like a precious treasure trove from other people or adversity. To cultivate a patient attitude, not feeling irritated or abused, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So, does anybody have anything they would like to say, ask, share about your experience working with patients this week? Any thoughts before we go on? Okay, Angela, I'm going to unmute you.
Well, I was doing well when everything was going well, but apparently I said bring it, and that worked very well for me. I had a very stressful time at work with a lot of mistakes, a lot of busy people, a lot of long hours, and I found out just how much patience I don't have. And I think that was good.
It's good. It doesn't sound like it was a pleasant week.
Well, it wasn't, but because I let it get on my nerves. I let it sort of take over instead of me just, you know, I can keep my practice very good when things are not that bad. Mm-hmm. You know, just normal. But when it's really stressful, I really have a hard time. You know?
That's funny. I was just thinking bring it on is kind of the theme of, of this verse. Or all the verses, really. Well, thanks for sharing that. I can totally relate to that. It is easy to practice when things are going well. And we need to practice. That's why we need to practice when things are going well. Because it's easy then and we can do it. And then when adversity strikes, we find out our limits. I mean, having kids, being a Dharma practitioner, like really trying to practice, you see where your limits are. Having children, I know you have kids. you see that you're not the person you thought you were. At least that was my experience. I thought I was much more patient than I was. So thanks for sharing that. And I'm going to go on to Valerie.
But I would still suggest that it probably was a little bit better than it was before. You know, I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'm not expressing that well. You probably did a little bit better than you thought you did.
Angela, I've unmuted you in case you want to say anything.
Yeah, I did a lot better because I probably would have quit or blown up. I just sort of had to change jobs instead of doing what I was doing. And I just really kept with the job and kept going through it. But I was really uncomfortable and I got complaining. Like I let complaining take over. It was like, I need to get out of this complaining. You know, that's becoming, that was too much of an old habit. So I did a lot better than I would have in the past. Yeah.
Yeah. I think just being aware. Valerie, did you have anything else you wanted to say?
No. It's what I tell myself. Like yeah. When I feel like Angela.
And I think that is the way to go. Like to realize our progress and to realize that just being aware of it, being able to define what's happening is really huge. Like just to know I'm really irritated. Like I've completely not been able to practice patience the way I would have liked to. You know, I've lashed out, I've held a grudge, I've, you know, whatever it is. Just to see it in the moment and be able to say what it is extremely liberating. And over time, the more we can do that, the more we can sync up our behavior with that too, or our emotions with that. Marilyn's mentioned this a few times in various contexts, because we've been studying the Paramitas in Washington, D.C. for quite some time. But she has said that she always comes back to the definition of patience, like imperturbability. And I personally find that really helpful too. It's like, I know I'm going into something stressful or I'm starting to feel the stress and I go, what would it feel like to like be imperturbable, like to not have anything bother me at all? And to know that that's possible, even if that's not the experience I'm living in the moment, I think it helps me to stay more in that space. So thanks for those comments. Anybody else have anything? There will be plenty of other opportunities during class. We're going to continue with, and welcome Namdok. We're going to continue with the Patience Paramita today. I was going to review Bodhisattva Boot Camp, but I think we all know basically, you know, it's a lot of situations, just examples of situations that try our patience, that where we tend to fall prey to the eight worldly concerns. We tend to get upset by circumstances, and the advice is the same in each one, that we can transform that situation into a Dharma teaching, into Dharma practice, and particularly by going straight to taking and sending. There's a specific remedy in each Bodhisattva Boot Camp verse. You know, for generosity, it's to just think you're giving everything. And, you know, if somebody humiliates you, it's to see them as your teacher and so forth. But it all comes down to others first. Like it all comes down to appreciating the opportunity to practice and taking in the suffering of the person who is tormenting you and sending out only positive things to them. So that's Bodhisattva Boot Camp in a nutshell. let's see. So we have a pop quiz. It can be a silent pop quiz, and it's also in my post, and it was in the email. I'm going to start focusing a little bit more on, like, what's the take home? Like, there's things in each, especially in the Paramitas, there's particular things that it's really useful to know. Like, it's worth the extra study to commit certain points from each Paramita to memory. So that you could say, like, if somebody says to you, what is the definition of patience? Could you come up with that? I just said what it was. So probably everybody can. It is not to be perturbed by anything. That's the official definition. Not to be perturbed by anything. And as I've said, and Marilyn has said, I carry that around with me now, just as I go into life. Or the image of Akshobhya, you know, the imperturbable Buddha. So second thing, so that's one take-home thing. Know the definition of each of the paramitas. We can backtrack a bit, maybe not today, but you could look those up. What's the definition of generosity? I'm not sure it's actually in the commentaries we're using.
Ornament of Precious Liberation, the structure of each chapter for each paramita is, it gives you the definition. So we may talk about the other definitions in the future, but for now, for patience, not to be perturbed, not to be bothered, your peace of mind undisturbed no matter what happens. And then the second take home is, what are the three kinds of patience? Because it's helpful, again, to define our situation, to know what it is we're walking into. Is it a person that's hurting me? Is someone trying to harm me, or someone just being irritating? That's the first kind of patience, is to be patient with that. The second one is to be patient with circumstances. So if you know you're walking into a situation where you're going to be stressed, not a person coming at you, but just circumstances stressing you, then we want to be patient with that. We want to be unperturbed by that. And in particular, in the context of the 37 practices, we're talking about being patient with circumstances that make our Dharma practice challenging, like not having enough time, having a really busy day, and we want to get our 15 minutes of meditation in, or whatever practice we do, and we just don't have time, and all we really want to do is relax and maybe watch a little TV or just sit and read a book or just chill out, but we need to do our Dharma practice if we want to make any progress. Or there's construction going on next door and it's really loud, or whatever it is that interferes with, if you have young kids, I lived through that one. If you have young kids and you just can't find the circumstances to do formal practice and you really depend on your formal practice, sometimes you do have to give that up and know that your practice is in your situation. So the first two are patience with people and patience with circumstances, especially with regard to Dharma practice. And then the third one is patience with the Dharma itself, like the things we don't get, especially the ideas that are too big for us. Like, what is the essence of everything? What is the nature of mind? What are the three kayas? Why don't I get that? And especially, what is emptiness? Is it a big abyss? Like, what am I walking into here? Even if we don't understand something, to not give up the Dharma because of that, not to turn away from it, because either we don't understand it yet or because it's a scary concept. Those are the three kinds of patience. So know those. I highly recommend. I can't make you know them. I have no authority here, but I can recommend that you be able to reel those off. And then the third one is, what are the three ways in which the teaching is that we need to be patient towards beings? Like that first category of patience, what are the three ways we practice it? So I'm going to give everybody a moment to see if you can come up with those. If anybody wishes to say what they are, then I will unmute you. So the first one is just not to be bothered. Like, we're starting with the hardest one. It's just don't be bothered by it. Somebody's harming you, so big deal. It's like a dream, right? It's just an illusion. Yesterday's weather, or it will be yesterday's weather in a few minutes. Don't be bothered. Second one, don't lash out, don't react, don't say something back or do something. And Andy and I had a little exchange about letting the air out of people's tires, and I really have never done that, even though I seem to use it as the example. I can't come up with examples of, like, what do we do physically to retaliate to people. I will say that I once did something that was a retaliation, and I told Andy that I might share that. And it was that I had a when my daughter was a baby, and we got no sleep at all. We had a neighbor downstairs whose theory of, like, not having his apartment broken into was to leave his radio on all the time at high volume, which kind of drove me crazy. And he was not amenable to, like, anything. If you asked him if he could lower the volume, he would turn it up. So, and he would also watch TV at night and fall asleep in front of the TV with it blaring. And this was back in the days. This is 1987, I guess, 1986, 87. Back in the day when, like, TV wasn't on all night. There were no cable channels. It was just like networks. And at, like, a certain time, 11 o'clock or midnight, it would go off and you'd get, like, a fuzzy screen. So one night when I was finally able to get some sleep because my daughter was sleeping, the TV came on and it blared all night. He obviously fallen asleep. I think I may have knocked on his door and gotten no response. So I went down to the basement and flipped the switch on his electricity. And what it did was it solved the problem. Like, it was just a problem solving thing because he was asleep. But I did take pleasure in the thought that the food in his freezer might thaw. And then the second part of it, the other issue was that I wake up really early, especially when you have a young child, like 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning. I went back downstairs and flipped it back on, so his TV came on really loud, and it obviously woke him up. So even looking back on it, I have to admit I enjoy that memory a bit. It's like it was my big retaliation. I didn't let the air out of his tires. I don't know if he had a car. But anyway, we don't do those things. That's the second way to practice patience towards people, is not to do those things. And then the third way is to not harbor resentment. Don't hold a grudge. The thing is over, just let go of it. So everybody got those? If not, like, the review is in all the commentaries and in my post. So anybody have anything, any retaliations they would like to share? Any confessions? We have some really good commentaries today. So last week we did Heart of Compassion, and we're going to just take a quick look at that again because this is so important. Before we go on to the other commentaries, on page 156. So first, he gives us the three kinds of patience, which we just went over. So that's a place, if you don't know them yet, you could look there. And then he gives us five ways to transform your thought process when someone is harming you. When you would normally get angry at the person, how can we either not become angry in the first place, or how can we sort of let the anger start to dissipate? So he gives us 5 ways, and also there's an even longer list in Ornament of Precious Liberation. These are so useful. You might want to write them down and post them somewhere where you would have handy access to them. So when you're being harmed by someone, first you can think that the harm that person may be inflicting on you or someone dear to you, as I think Kathy was pointing out last week, but that's when she gets revved up, is the direct result of you yourself having harmed others in the past. So we remember karma. This would not be happening to me if I had not sown the seeds for it. Second one, reflect that the person is so overpowered by delusion that he or she is as if possessed and cannot resist harming you. In short, they've been overcome. They're under the influence of anger, like their own suffering. Something's triggering them, so they're harming you. And so it's like dealing with a person who is drunk, intoxicated, or possibly mentally ill. Like, they're not in their right mind when they are under the influence of anger. So we don't hold it against them. Number three, remember that they're going to suffer as a result of harming you. That's going to cause them suffering in the future. And we feel compassion for them. That's a way to bring up compassion for them. And when we're not allowed to rejoice that the suffer, you know, that their karma will take care of the situation ultimately. So that's, remember our own karma. Remember that they're under the influence of anger and not really themselves. And third, that they're going to suffer because of what they're doing. So we don't have to make them suffer. Fourth, remember that if we remain patient, when we normally would, our anger would be triggered, it burns off negative karma. Like, we're burning off negative karma we didn't even get to yet. So just like it's said that anger, a moment of anger can destroy a lifetime of merit, also a moment of patience can destroy a lifetime of anger or negative karma. So, and then the fifth one is to remember emptiness, which is what makes it a paramita or a transcending action. Like, so far, it's just ordinary patience, and that's a wonderful thing. All of the paramitas are wonderful, even as an ordinary virtue. But we turn them into an action that can help us realize our Buddha nature, that can help us become awakened if we remember that they're really empty. And it's very nicely put here in Dino Chansey's commentary, so I'll read that again. Moreover, when you look even more deeply into what is happening, you will see that the person being harmed, the person doing the harm, and the harm itself are all totally devoid of any inherent existence. Who is going to get angry at delusions? So if we remember that it's all an illusion, it's all like a dream, it's all not solid, it's not lasting, it's impermanent, it's fleeting, it's not exactly the way we see it either. Like we don't see things exactly the way they are. It's our delusion as well. So there's no reason to get angry. And he says, in these empty phenomena, what is there to be gained or lost? What is there to want or to reject? Understand it all as being like the vast empty sky. So we want to remember that for all of the paramitas. We transform generosity into a paramita in exactly the same way. I guess we transform ethical conduct in the same way. I haven't really seen that explained as such. But I guess when we're helping a little old lady cross the street, we can remember there's no little old lady and there's no one being helped across the street, no one helping them across the street and no street to help them across maybe. So anyway, always remembering the emptiness aspect. So we're going to go on to a commentary we have not used yet. It is His Holiness, the 17th Karmapa, has a very small book on the 37 practices. It's called Traveling the Path of Compassion. The commentaries are really, really short, generally. and usually I don't really find that they add anything, so I don't usually bring them in. But he does add something in that I haven't seen in any of their commentaries, and that is the downside, or how we can do a paramita wrong. How can you do generosity wrong? How can you do ethical conduct wrong? How can you do patience wrong? So we can go astray. This is a really big reason why it's said that we need a teacher. We need a spiritual friend, someone with realization to help us along the path. In the Ornament of Precious Liberation, you know, it's said that we need a guide. We need an escort. We need a boatman, someone who knows the way, so we won't fall into the pitfalls. So what's the pitfall of patience? He says, the third perfection is patience, which also has an obstacle called the demon of too much struggling or too much patience. Patience, like generosity and discipline, should not be too extreme, but should arise freely through our understanding. When we have love and compassion, we naturally understand why the afflictions occur and do not struggle to be patient. For example, when sick, some people keep on struggling with the illness and refuse to take any treatment. So this is like bring it on. It's a little bit like bring it on to a really extreme degree. No, I'm going to practice patience towards my illness. I'm not going to take any medicine. So he says that's really, that's taking patience too far. In general, we should not put up with everything or do everything that anyone asks us to do. And that's getting into the second way we can go wrong with patience. It's not about doing everything that anyone asks us to. Enduring too much has the drawback of giving others the opportunity to do negative things. So this is something we've talked about in a lot of contexts in this study of the 37 practices. It's never about being a doormat. You don't want to let somebody keep doing something to you that's harming you, because we remember that they're incurring negative karma. So if harm is really occurring, then we may need to stop it. But, you know, we do it gently without our mind being disturbed, if that's at all possible. He said, we could also be too impatient with our own afflictions. That seems to mean giving ourselves too much leeway. Like, well, yes, I know I'm not supposed to eat the gallon of ice cream because it's suffering and it's going to cause suffering to the other people who wanted some of the ice cream. But I'm going to be patient with myself because I'm not perfect. So we've talked a lot about not being too critical of ourselves, because we tend to fall into that, too much self-criticism. But we also don't want to give ourselves too much leeway, according to the Karmapa. Because obviously, if without reason a person told us to eat something obnoxious, we would do it without thinking if we were being excessively patient. He says it might not be easy for us, but we can immediately say, I will not do that. So it's okay to have boundaries, in short. Like, I would say that that's a good way to sum this up, is that it's okay to have boundaries. We don't have to let everybody do whatever they want all the time or take advantage of us. So, I wanted to backtrack, though, and tell you, he didn't give a downside to generosity, but I think you're getting into something very like what we've discussed as idiot compassion. Giving people, and this is a question that comes up, I know that it's been asked a few times, like giving somebody money on the street and you know that they're going to use it to buy drugs. Well, if you know that for sure, then yeah, you don't want to help them harm themselves. You might want to find another way to be generous or kind to that person. If we don't know and we only suspect, then generally the teaching has been to err on the side of generosity. But if we know for sure that our generosity is going to be used to harm somebody, then we wouldn't give something. And also, same thing, it overlaps patience here. Like being too generous in the sense of giving people too much sway over us or allowing them to harm us. And then for ethical conduct, he says, when misunderstood, here's where he first starts to explain the whole concept. When misunderstood, the perfections can have a darker side, which is metaphorically called a demon. The downside of the perfection of discipline or ethical conduct is called the demon of austerity, taking on discipline as a hardship and making it into a struggle. Done right, discipline is taken on joyfully and with a clear understanding of why engaging in it is good. So you don't want to, you don't want your ethical conduct or your discipline to become like a hair shirt or flagellating yourself. You know, it should just arise naturally within situations and, again, not be taken too far. So that's what the Karmapa has to say about how we can go wrong with patience and the other paramitas. And we'll look at it again for the other ones. I can't even imagine how you could go too far with wisdom. we'll be in suspense about that one. He may not even say. All right, so I'm also, anybody have anything they want to say or ask or share before I go on? Yes, Andy, you are unmuted.
Since the idea of idiot compassion came up, or maybe it was already happening, but I started to catch a new flavor in my so-called bodhicitta that I don't like very much. And a quality of, I think there's something genuine there, but I think that you thinking about it and studying it and determining to do it, it also gets mixed up with ego and image and actually tends to make you feel that you exist in a way you don't. It makes you solid. You think, oh, I'm so good, I'm so generous, you know, and it becomes just like you said, like an effort.
Yeah.
It eases apart. It's kind of very disturbing.
I understand what you're saying, and I think that the actual antidote to that is the exact thing that makes the paramitas transcendent, is like whatever we're doing, whatever dharma activity we're doing or whatever paramita we're engaging in, remember that there's no one receiving it, no one giving it, and nothing being transacted. I think that's it, but it's a very subtle thing sometimes. You know, I definitely understand what you're saying, and I don't think we can get the ego out of it. I think that takes care of itself. You can't like forcefully get the ego out. So this is a place we might have to be a little patient. Like, okay. Yeah, I'm doing this partly out of my ego, but I'm still doing a good thing. And I'm going to conceptually remind myself that there's nothing happening here. No one receiving, no one giving, no one, and nothing, no transaction. Does that address that at all?
Yeah. And I guess my experience is that I could tell the difference when it's spontaneous and without any kind of, you know, premeditation, then it feels very like lovely and open and without concept. And when I think about it beforehand, I'm going to do this good deed, you know, I'm going to do that good deed.
Yeah.
It poisons it, you know, in a weird way.
Yeah, but it's still a good thing to do. Like, if it's a good thing to do, it's still a good thing to do. John says he can't really hear you. I think you're a little far from the microphone.
I'm sorry, is that better?
Do you want to, John, can you hear him now? I'm sorry, John, can you give a thumbs? Yeah, okay. So do you just want to briefly reiterate that?
Yeah, just briefly what it is that I sort of noticed the element of ego and the bodhicitta getting mixed up with ego and a sense of how great I was to be so generous and a kind of deliberate quality that just didn't, just kind of made it kind of yucky, actually.
Well, just the mere recognition of that should give you hope, Andy. You know, again, it's like Angela with her bad week where she felt she didn't live up to her, you know, her ideals. It's just being aware and being able to say that is like 90% of the journey.
Okay. I'm looking for the other 10%.
Yeah, well, maybe that's bodhisattva level 7. I think we might have to be patient with it for a while. But when we notice that our ego's involved, we can back off from that a little bit. You know, I think it's all concepts, right? Ego and concepts are kind of the same thing. And nobody needs to quote me on that because, well, it's recorded. But just in a sort of analogous way, you know. So you can't fight your way out of it with concepts. You just,
right.
Like, it's exactly what you said, that when it's spontaneous and not premeditated, it flows and it feels like there's no ego in it. We can't make that happen, but we can be aware of the difference, which is what you're doing. And the rest takes care of itself with Dharma practice. I mean, we really have to let go. I think one of the reasons Dharma practice becomes tedious and can feel like a burden is because we feel like it's such a slog. Like, I have to free myself from samsara. I have to meditate for 15 minutes. I have to be generous and patient and unperturbed. Well, we don't. We just have to know. We have to study, contemplate, and meditate. And we have to let go of like what in another context was discussed in Suzuki Roshi's words of a gaining concept or a gaining idea. You know, we don't really have to accomplish anything, and that's the joke. Like when you get into Mahamudra, that's a joke. There's nothing. So the less you do, the less you struggle, the quicker, I think, the more you get there. But so conceptually, we're not going to solve it. But through practice, we will. We just let the practice take effect, and we don't worry about it, I think. So I'm going to mute you, Andy, and unmute Namdak. Okay.
Hi, Lama. That was my situation for the few months that I missed class. Was I felt my Dharma practice was a slog, and I felt I wasn't getting anywhere, and I expected so much of myself that it just seemed like taking a break was the right thing to do for me. But now I feel like I'm back.
Yeah.
I just needed a break because I was pressuring myself too much to, and I thought, geez, I've been practicing for 30 years and what have I accomplished? I felt like I've accomplished very little.
Yeah. Well, in a way, that's probably true for all of us, but it's the little bit, like that's where the mold is.
Thank you.
When we each reach our deathbed, I think we're going to discover that we accomplished a lot.
I'm sure you're right.
And that's what Rinpoche said. I remember at least one time him saying that when we get to the big adversity or we get to the deathbed, that's when we're going to recognize the benefit. It's hard to see on a day-to-day basis, and it can become a slog. But generally, I think when it's a slog, it means we're having our expectations are too firm, too solid. And we just need to engage in practice just for the practiceness of it. And there is joy in practice when you let go of what you know, the idea of what you should be accomplishing through this. Like, I should be so much better by now. Well, if you're a little better, Sita Rinpoche says, that's great, you did your job. So just keep going. All right, anybody else before we go on? Yes, Dan, I'm unmuting you.
Yeah, all last month I was just like putting the bolts on myself, tightening them, you know?
Yeah.
And I just had to lighten up, basically.
And
I was very, very serious about, like, you know, just everything. And I just had to just kind of, lighten up. It helped out a lot.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us, like, in what ways? Was it just a mental thing that you lightened up? Or, like, numbed up? Did you have to just take a break from expecting what you might accomplish in terms of actual practice?
Yeah, well, just, like, putting the pressure on myself, the main thing, yeah. And just, like, and meditating out in my backyard and just, like, listening to the crickets and, like, feeling the breeze because I was, like,
so that was
I have my spot in my house. This is where I have to do it. And then just kind of, like, allowing myself to, like, that freedom to just plant myself when I felt like it. Yeah. And that was a good start of just the lightening up process, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And it was I don't know, it wasn't so hard to sit for half an hour either.
And one way we can lighten up is like what Andy was talking about is like if we recognize that our practice is like, you know, we have some ego in the game, it's like, oh, you just laugh at that. Okay, you know, you don't have to get rid of that, you just notice it. For me, that's the most helpful thing, is just realizing that awareness is what it's all about. You can't dismantle something mechanically. You know, but the more you're aware of it, the less you fall into it. Sort of, it solves itself. All right, anybody else? From John Winish. Sounds like Dharma quicksand. It's best to be still and relaxed to get through it. I don't know, it says that was just to me, so I don't know if you meant to share that with everybody, John, but no, I just did. Yes, thank you, Dharma. Yes, you can get into Dharma quicksand. I think that's a really good image for it. You can definitely get into Dharma quicksand. And how do you get out of quicksand? Everybody knows, right, how you get out of quicksand. I don't know if, like, that's even something people think about now that everything's urbanized and paved over. There used to be quicksand. And everybody knows, right? Anybody not know how to get out of quicksand? Valerie, you don't know? Stop struggling. Because the more you move to try to get out, the deeper you sink. So you have to just stop, and then you wait for somebody to come along and throw you a rope, I guess. trying to free yourself, it's really exactly the same. Trying to free yourself only digs you in deeper. It just becomes more and more ego and concepts. So we just let go, like Namdok and Dan are testifying, have worked for them recently. Anybody else? All right, then we're going to look now at Kempo Sultram Jamso Rinpoche. And again, you know, this is, I think it's out of print. He was like the pioneer who introduced this practice, at least, you know, in my awareness. He taught it at KTC back in the 80s. And we all got his little book and translation with the Tibetan, and I think it's out of print now. But he too adds something that we haven't seen in the other commentaries, although it's classic. I'm going to reiterate, we went over this last week, but he also gives the definition of patience. He says, what is patience? The genuine definition of patience, everybody knows it, right? Is the mental ability to remain unperturbed by negative conditions. So he says the Mahayana Sutra Lankara, that's a sutra, or it's actually a commentary on a sutra, describes patience as having four qualities. This is another list we could learn. I don't know if this one needs it. The other stuff is probably more important. But what are the four qualities of patience? The first is that it pacifies anger. Anger and patience are direct opposites. If you are angry, you are not being patient. And if you are not being patient, you are not behaving like a bodhisattva. So again, we might not be able to stop our behavior in every circumstance, but just being aware that, oh, darn, I just did it again, is really, really helpful and helps to take the tyranny out of it. Like, anger is not going to catch you quite as easily if you develop an alertness to it. So first quality of patience, it pacifies anger. Second quality of patience, it is endowed with non-conceptual primordial wisdom. So this is different wisdom from the wisdom paramita. The wisdom paramita is shera. It's the acquired wisdom. It's the understanding that everything is empty. This is non-conceptual primordial wisdom, which is the same as Buddha nature. It's the wisdom we already have that we're trying to gain access to through all of this practice. So it is endowed with non-conceptual primordial wisdom. Bodhisattvas who completely understand this point realize the selflessness of phenomena and of the individual. So what he's stating here is that to get to non-conceptual primordial wisdom, which is yeshe in Tibetan, you have to develop the other kind of wisdom, sherab, the wisdom that realizes the selflessness of phenomena and the individual. So the third quality of patience is that one comes to like all sentient beings. I think this one's very lovely. If you have patience, you like everybody. Nobody bothers you. Nobody harms you. He says, this is not a matter of saying, oh, I like everybody. That would be what Andy's talking about, sort of the egotistical, arrogant one, like, I like everybody, and sort of forcing it on every situation. A bodhisattva who has complete patience with everything hurtful or harmful bears affection towards everyone and can bring happiness everywhere. This ability to bestow happiness on all sentient beings is a sign that the paramita of patience has been perfected. So we all want to be that person who goes into every room and every meeting and every situation with this open heart radiating love and compassion and sort of changes the dynamic. And we know that that can happen. The same way that if somebody angry walks into the room, suddenly that changes the dynamic. Somebody completely open and loving and not worrying if somebody's going to try to hurt them or irritate them. Somebody imperturbable walks into the room. And we've had that happen if we've known a teacher like Lama Rinpoche or Sita Rinpoche or Minja Rinpoche or any of the others. They walk into the room and everything changes, like everything simmers down. One of the things I remember and may have said before about, I rarely asked to meet with Lama Narla Rinpoche. I rarely asked for an interview, but every once in a while, there would be some problem or some issue or some burning question. And I would ask and I would go and it would immediately, it was like, well, this isn't important. Like in his presence, it simply dissolved. And of course, when I left, it might, like if I didn't go ahead and ask the thing or whatever, it might come back later. But there was just this like spontaneous pacification that would happen just to be in his presence. And it happened again and again and again, like, oh, this isn't important after all. Oh, not such a big deal. It's like his imperturbability like made me a little bit less perturbable. So this ability to bestow happiness on all sentient beings is a sign that the paramita of patience has been perfected. So we will be like that when we've practiced patience enough. What can the fourth quality be? Like, what could possibly be left that is good about patience? The fourth quality is that through perfecting patience, one can help others progressively develop their Dharma practice. This ability is called ripening others through the three vehicles. Starting with the Shravakayana, and Patrick, there is an answer to your question of what are other things to call the Hinayana. Shravakayana is a mouthful, but that's actually probably the most accurate. starting with the Shravakayana and proceeding through the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, a bodhisattva guides beings along the path, helping them decrease their afflictions and suffering and increase their compassion and wisdom. So I think these four might be worth committing to memory, and I'll list them in my post, which I'll get up in the next couple of days. So pop quiz, what are the four qualities of patience? I probably couldn't reel them off, but the first one is it pacifies anger. The second one is that it is endowed with non-conceptual primordial wisdom. It's like it's immediate access to your Buddha nature. Patience and Buddha nature are like the same thing in a way. It's the entryway to Buddha nature. I might put it that way just because it's easier to say. Third is that it makes you like everyone. There's no one you don't like. And the fourth one is it makes you able to help people cultivate their own patience through Dharma practice. So that's something to chew on for a while. So that brings us up to, we have 20 minutes left. Anybody have anything they wanted to say? Okay. We're going to look very quickly at Pema Chodron, if I can remember where I put her. There she is. And then we're going to read as much of Ken's commentary as we have time for, because once again, like he doesn't always do it, but in this chapter he comes through and sort of really puts this into Western terms and practical terms, like how can we practice this in real life, that's really, I find very helpful. So first, Pema Chodron in her 2016 teachings at Omega Institute. She said, to practice patience, you need someone who irritates you. You learn to say, and we're going to see more of that in Ken's commentary. You need someone who irritates you. You learn, and through this, you learn to sit still with the restlessness of the energy of the anger that wants to strike out, or of the craving that wants more. Because that's also practicing patience when we have an impulse. We want something, and we don't jump to it. Like, we sit with it. Patience is learning to sit with that, because that's the mind being perturbed. It's not only perturbed by things that make us angry, but it's perturbed by things that make us want something, by impulses, by desires. Not to speak or act out of it, but to feel what you're feeling. So she said this very concisely, and this was an oral teaching. So to unpack that just a little bit, we need someone who irritates us so that we can learn to just sit with that feeling, like not to suppress the feeling. We get to feel what we feel, but not to act or speak out of that feeling, but to be able to sit with the restlessness of the energy of the anger that would really like to say something right now, or would really like to let the air out of that person's tires or turn off his electricity so that you can turn it back on in the morning and wake him up. So it's about, a lot of this is about learning to contain emotional impulses. You know, I mean, I think psychotherapy works on that front too in different ways, but it's about being able to be with whatever we're feeling and just notice it, just be aware of it, just let it flow through our awareness. It all has a beginning and an end, you know, because it's phenomena. So if you don't react, it's like, how many times have we realized in our life that we said or did the thing, and then 5 minutes later or the next day, we don't even care about that thing anymore. Like, it was just an impulse of the moment. It just triggered us in some way. And we, when we're not feeling that trigger, it doesn't bother us at all. Like, what is that? So we're learning to sit with being triggered, not do anything until the feeling actually passes, which it will. So I'm going to turn to Ken now for our last 15 minutes or so. We're going to read his commentary in verse 27. If you have that and you want to read along, that's great. I can't give you a page number because I'm in that Kindle edition. So he says, how serious are you about working through your emotional reactions? Are you like John of the Cross, the 16th century Spanish mystic? After being tortured by the Inquisition, he was pardoned. To redress the injuries done to him, albeit in a small way, he was given a choice of monasteries in which to live. He chose a monastery whose abbot detested him. When asked why, he replied that he wanted to deepen his practice of patience. So that's like Angela thinking, bring it on. It's like, okay, he brought it on. It's like, give me something that will irritate me every single day. And he wouldn't have had to do that if he practiced patience perfectly. He knew it was going to irritate him. Otherwise, he wouldn't even need to bother. He's bringing on something he knows is going to push his buttons because he wants his buttons pushed, because otherwise he won't be able to develop the level of patience where they eventually won't bother him. So now here's an example we're more familiar with. Are you like Atisha, the 11th century Indian master? When he came to Tibet, he included an especially obnoxious young boy in his entourage, again, to be sure to have an opportunity to practice patience, because he had been assured that the Tibetans were so nice that no one would ever irritate him. And he later said he didn't really need to bring the tea boy. The Tibetans really weren't that nice. There would have been plenty of irritation. But these are two people who chose to bring it on. Like, they made sure to put themselves in a situation where they would be constantly subjected to irritating things. So now he gets into our experience. What are our equivalents of the tea boy and the abbot who hates us? What about your roommate who never cleans up the mess he made in the kitchen? Or the person beside you at work who is always humming a song out of tune? Or the customer service person who refuses quietly and calmly to help you with your problem? Or the person who just backed into you and is blaming you for the dent in his car? Like, those are just a few of the situations we might encounter. It is hard to see these everyday irritations as opportunities, as treasures, says Ken. When someone steps on your toes, literally or figuratively, you feel a wave of reactive energy. This is what Pema Chodron was talking about. We feel that energy. That impulse to anger comes up. It surges through your body. Anger, frustration, hurt, panic, resentment. You cannot tolerate it. None of us have ever felt that, right? If you do not recognize this energy surge, again, we're coming back to awareness being the solution. Like, what's going to happen is going to happen. You cannot tolerate it. If you do not recognize this energy surge, it takes you over and pours out in angry words. Then you have a mess to clean up. If you do recognize it, can you stay in the turmoil without expressing it or suppressing it? Maybe you do not lose your temper, but you just quietly turn away and have nothing more to do with this person. Atisha fires his T-boy, so he won't have to put up with him anymore. Maybe you adopt an air of superiority, however subtle, and feel that you are taking the high road. That's Andy's thing of like practicing patience from an ego point of view. Like, I am being patient with this irritating person. These are still forms of suppression because the anger is still in your body. Reactions are insidious. So what's the solution? Ken has one for us. He says, you have to train and train. If you have to remember to practice patience in the moment, you have not trained enough. And you inevitably fall into some subtle form of expression or suppression. That is a lot better than spewing obscenities or bottling up your feelings, but it is not patience, not yet. And that's fine. This is just recognizing. Like, no, I'm not a bodhisattva. I'm not a perfect bodhisattva yet. I still get irritated. Doesn't mean that that's a bad thing. Like, we're not becoming self-critical now because we didn't perfect patience yet. This is just a way to measure. Like, yes, I have to hold it in, so I still have a little ways to go. He says, like it or not, it really is helpful to have a person in your life who is a constant annoying nuisance. At first, he irritates you. You do your best to persuade him to behave differently. Don't we do that? Just put the cap on the toothpaste. I never had that problem either, by the way. When persuasion does not work, and it generally doesn't, you try coercion. He is impervious. No matter what you say or do, it is clear that person is not going to change. This nuisance is not going away. So you have a choice. Be constantly irritated, or what? What's the alternative? You grit your teeth as you realize that if you want any peace, you are going to have to deal with your own reactions. What else can you do? You start to pay attention to those reactions. So that's like Angela noticing that she was getting stressed and irritated. You start to pay attention. How am I feeling? What is this doing to my body? The anger, the outrage, the feeling of being ignored. Notice those things. You become aware of how your body goes into knots and spasms every time you see or talk with this person. You're obsessed with stories about what a horrible and inconsiderate person he is. Have we ever done that? Like, just rehashed it and brought up all the old grievances too? And what a noble and mistreated victim you are. Meanwhile, this person is happily going about his or her day. You are the one suffering. And that's one of the key reasons that's given not to carry anger around with us, because who does it hurt? It doesn't hurt the other person that we're angry with them. It's Pema Chodron said or quoted a line that's always stayed with me, like, holding on to anger is like eating rat poison and thinking the rat will die. So what do? With no other option available, you pay more attention to what goes on in you. Since nothing else has worked, you decide to let him be him and not try to change him, and to let your reactions be and not try to change them. So we're not trying to change anything in the situation, and that's the key. We're not trying to change the person and remove the irritation. We're not trying to not get angry. We're just going to notice what happens. So we let our reactions be, and we don't try to change them. They surge and they clamor for attention, but you let them come and go. and they do come and go. They are not constant. That is the first bit of good news for you. If you sit, if you're able to refrain from reacting, and you just sit with it, and you don't try to suppress it, but you just sit there and let yourself feel that anger, it's going to go away. It's like you won't even notice it going away. You'll just be thinking of something else in 10 minutes. And it's a really good thought experiment, and I have done this. Try to hold on to it. Say, I'm going to never let go of this anger even for a moment. You cannot do that. It's not possible. I'm not sure that that's a really positive, constructive thought experiment, but it is a real, like, it's a lesson that your mind can't hold on to something that, even something that powerful that seems to completely control you, it's going to go away, and you can't make it stop. You can't make it stay. So the second bit of good news, first bit of good news is it's going to change. Second bit of good news is that you now have other options. You can, of course, continue to fight with your feelings, but you can also observe, explore, or analyze them. Any of these may be helpful, though you usually fall into thinking very easily. So this is not thinking. This is not a storyline. We're letting go of that, but we can analyze the emotion itself. And we could do it sort of in the way that Ken's meditation did it. Like, take the anger, because the first example he works with, I think, is an emotion. Like, if it just happens, like, you don't have to create it, but you just find yourself in the middle of anger or strong desire or whatever it is, you can just do that meditation. Like, where is that located? How is it different from the way it feels in my body? Where is the emotion itself? And then you realize, I can't say. And by the time you realize, I can't say, it's already started to flow into something else, like the next thing. So he says, more helpful is to open to them. So he says analysis itself is really not. It's hard to maintain without getting back into conceptuality or thinking. More helpful is to open to the emotion, look into it, or receive and accept it. With these approaches, you are less likely to fall into thinking and more likely to discover through your own experience that you do not have to be run by your feelings, that you could coexist with a feeling and it wouldn't be able to tell you what to do. How extraordinary, says Ken. Through this nuisance, you have discovered a dimension of freedom, because that is exactly what freedom is. It's imperturbability. It's having your button pushed and not reacting to it. You know, whether it's like the ultimate not reacting of not being bothered, or whether it's just the sort of lesser freedom of knowing that you can contain and coexist with this emotion as long as it lasts, and you don't have to say or do something out of it that you will later regret or that will make the situation worse. So he says, now you train so that freedom is always available to you. That's the freedom we're looking for. Like, you could experience that freedom anytime you do this process of not suppressing, like, your emotional reaction, but not reacting out of it either, simply letting it be and coexisting with it and being aware of it, just resting in awareness of it. It's like a free meditation. So he says, so now you train so that freedom is always available to you, first in easier, less demanding interactions, and then in more and more difficult ones. So he's talking about training, like, you train in the ones that you can train in. I mean, you might, if it's an overwhelming thing, then you may not be able to train in it at that moment. You may have to react and then pick up the pieces later, and then you could use it as training. But if it's a small irritation, and those are the ones where I go, okay, imperturbability is an option, and this is something that usually irritates me. And just by saying that, usually I don't get irritated if I can catch it like that. So that's freedom. So he says, the perfection of patience, the transcendent action of patience, involves another step and a different quality of patience. So we're back into, like, this is the same sort of sequence that, this is really exactly the same sequence that Dingo Chensei Rinpoche went through. He just gave us ways to think about it, whereas Ken is going directly to just rest in it, like, give up all the thoughts and just rest in it. It's still ordinary patience. So Dingo Chensei followed his suggestions up with, like, how to make it transcendent patience, and so does Ken. He says, The perfection of patience involves another step and a different quality of patience, a deeper level of patience, I would say, which is to ask, what is that stillness? What is that space in which reactions arise and disappear? So we're really applying the second step of the ultimate bodhicitta sequence in Great Path of Awakening, which is, like, first you could back off. It's like a dream, right? You don't have to react to it because it's like a dream. And then you look at the mind that's seeing it as like a dream. So you look at the mind that is aware of the reaction. And you say, what is that stillness or that space in which reactions arise and disappear? Where is it coming from? In short, you're looking at mind or awareness itself. He says, when you look at it, you see nothing at all. It is a bit frightening. It is like looking into the void of outer space. Something in you shrinks back. That's the third kind of patience. It's like, this is scary to sit here with this emotion and just let it be. And so rather than be impatient, not be able to contain that, get irritated with that, be afraid of that, he says, this is the other level of patience, letting your reactions to that infinite nothingness come and go. But do not stop there. You can ask, what are those reactions? So you look deeply at the reaction itself. So first he has us looking at the space in which the reactions come and go, and then we can focus in on the reaction itself. Look deeply. They seem to be movement, but at the same time, nothing is moving. So what he's done here, all of us who have had teachings on, for example, the ocean of definitive meaning, will recognize this as stillness and movement. It's three parts, stillness, movement, awareness, right? So with awareness, you know whether it's stillness or whether it's movement. And stillness is that background, it's the space in which it occurs. And movement is the reaction itself, the thoughts, the emotions, and so forth. And so we apply awareness to know which one it is or to examine whichever one it is. And he says, so what do? We've got stillness or we've got movement. What do we do with it? You know what he's going to say, right? He says, do not try to sort this out. Just rest and look. Look and rest. Here you find a different kind of freedom, a freedom that is both peace and clarity at the same time, or emptiness and luminosity at the same time would be another way to say that. We're looking directly at the nature of mind through this process. It brings us to looking at the nature of mind, which is where we want to be all the time. So that's the end of Ken's commentary and the end of all the commentaries. Does anybody have, we've got a couple of minutes left, does anybody have anything they'd like to ask or share? We have a lot to work with. Yes, Marilyn, I'm going to unmute you. Okay.
One of the things that I really love about the path that we're on is the word transformation, as opposed to trying to get rid of something.
Yeah.
It's just another example of that. No, you're not trying to get rid of it, you know, which of course doesn't work.
Yes, it doesn't work. Sometimes it can be the first step, though, like sort of, because patience and anger can't coexist, right? So sometimes you can push the anger out with patience. That's the ego. But anyway, yes, you're right. You're right. It's about transformation. I'm just thinking of, like, when we're really overwhelmed by an emotion and we kind of can't get our footing with it. Sometimes the first thing we do is change the channel, which is kind of like getting rid of it, except that you can't get rid of it, it's going to come back. But by continuing to change the channel to something else, you kind of take the wind out of it and get it, you know, down to something that you can work with in a transformational way. Yes, thank you. Anything else? Okay, anybody else? All right. Well, next week, so we've been through the first three paramitas, and next week we'll be on to the paramita of, okay, so what do we call it? We've got perseverance, we've got effort, we've got diligence, we've got joyful enthusiasm. I think I'm going to go with the term that Mingyur Rinpoche is using, which is joyful effort, just because Mingyur Rinpoche is using it. By the way, if anybody needs another class, Mingyur Rinpoche's class, online class on the six paramitas, just started in May. You can travel it at your own, you know, pace. I just took his course on Mahamudra, which was just life-changing. It was just an amazing class. But there are prerequisites for that one. There's no prerequisites for the Paramitas, I don't think. There is a cost to it. It's you, what you have to do is you go, and I can send this information out. I'll send a link. You just go to his website, and his website for his classes, and you sign up for their Vajrayana online program, and it's $50 a month. There is a scholarship. I mean, I think you can get it for $25 a month if you can't afford $50. Because there are people who donate to help sponsor other people. But for $50 a month, you have access to all of his online classes, any of them. And the one I took is so worthwhile. I'm going to do the Paramitas as well. And it, again, it just started May 1st. So they're very intense. There's a lot of homework. You don't have to do it all. And they say that up front. You can do any level of it that you want. But if you do the whole thing, the one I just took was a lot of reading. I mean, I'm behind. I still have a couple of modules. Well, one module left to go. But anyway, that's a plug for if you want another class, you have extra time. Then he's teaching the Paramitas right now, and it's not just him. He's got senior students who also teach, Cortland Dahl and Tim Olmsted. But he does teaching. He does a video teaching for each section. And he also does webinars, live webinars, which you can access after the fact too. So anyway, there's a lot of resources there, and I will send that link. I'm writing that down, send link to Tergar. Okay. All right. So next week we're on, so I'm just using, that's just because I'm going to say joyful effort. It's not my favorite necessarily. I actually like diligence because the idea of joyful is always already in it if you know Latin, but people don't know that. So diligence sounds grim. We're trying to make diligence not sound grim, like this Paramita, because it's supposed to be joyful, to like persist in your Dharma practice with a joyful mind, not a slog. That's something we aim for, and that's what gets us through. So anyway, we will do our prayers now. Put them under a bunch of books now. Okay. Our dedication prayers, again, remembering all the sentient beings on his behalf. We're doing all of this joyful slogging. We could call it joyful slogging. All right. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence. Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And let's just bring our minds to rest for a split second. Just in that sense of you can't say, like, where is this? Just resting in awareness. And now I will unmute everybody. Okay, you're unmuted.
Good to see you, Namdok.
Thank you so much. It's good to be back.
Okay, good to see everybody. Have a great week. Practice patience. Report back next week. And we will be on to joyful slogging.